Hey folks, Eric here. Before we get this episode started, I just wanted to let you know of a couple ways you can help the show out. Follow us on Twitter at @TrekAboutShow, like us on Facebook by searching for Trek About on Facebook, and the best way to help the show out would be to review us on iTunes. Now let's get this show started.
So I'm starting to get really excited every time I see written by Melinda Snodgrass at the beginning of an episode, because she actually gets what this series I think is supposed to be.
That's interesting, because I get excited whenever I see a picture of Melinda Snodgrass because she is quite attractive.
She is cute. That's objectification, Eric.
It is, but that's fine. She's okay with it. I asked her. We're best friends.
I thought I was your best friend.
I can have more than one best friend.
Yeah, but why haven't I met Melinda Snodgrass?
Richard, we're not really friends, okay? It's a painful subject for me.
Oh, you and me are Melinda Snodgrass and you.
So, yeah, no, I think she's great. And, you know, I don't know to what degree I should kind of like spoil Melinda Snodgrass for you. You know, because
it turns out she was really Gene Roddenberry.
Yeah, she was. No, she doesn't stick with the show that long, which is kind of unfortunate, I think, because, you know, I think she's the first writer on the show that really does get the show. And she does a good job of juggling technobabble plots with really humanizing elements. And what I like about Pen Pals is that while they have all this sort of stuff about the dilithium things on the planet that are causing it to, to whatever, it doesn't really matter. She balances it with this really nice story between Data and this alien. And also, and more surprisingly, I think, she's able to write a Wesley story that isn't horrible.
You know, that was the thing. This isn't – there is something missing from this episode, and maybe it's the plot. It's not the greatest or most interesting plot that we've seen. But number one, the script itself doesn't really care about its mechanics. Like last week, we were saying the script thought that the time travel was important, but it couldn't figure it out. Here, it doesn't really matter what's happening to this planet. Something's happening, and they've got to figure it out. That's really all that they care about, and that's all as much as the episode kind of really cares about it. It only kind of briefly goes over a few things. Again, technobabble is a perfect perfect term for what this episode is. But it's not a problem. But all of the characters are really excellent in this. I mean, you kind of like everybody, and everyone is doing something very true to themselves. And, I mean, Wesley's plot could have gone either way. It could have been a typical plot of, well, Wesley's really, you know, he's this prodigy, and he's arrogant, and he's gonna, you know... One of the first things that they tell him when he gets the command is, you know, all of these people are here. They have a lot of experience. They're resources for you. You know, don't just, you know, Picard says I would rather have an officer who asks a question or, you know, admits that he's unsure about something than one who just kind of makes a snap decision just to make a decision. And to Wesley's credit, he does this. And this episode is actually about him learning the points when he does have enough confidence to. I mean, I think we'd said a few weeks ago that, you know, in the first season, Wesley gets shown to be this prodigy. Maybe within the regular, you know, school, he's probably the smartest kid in his class. Now he's actually on the level of, you know, he's on Starfleet level now, and he's kind of getting hard stuff for the first time. Things are difficult for him, I think, for the first time. And he, in this episode, at least, he's humbled by that. And I like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a degree to which Wesley is still a problematic character because, you know, you know, if you think about it logically for 30 seconds, it's patently ridiculous that any sort of, you know, professional military or whatever Starfleet is organization would put a 15-year-old kid in charge of something as important as this.
That was a...
And, you know, but that's part of the show, and they have sort of, I think... you know, repivoted the character of Wesley, you know, kind of tamped down some of the more ridiculous elements of his personality and his characterization. He's a sort of prodigy and he's very intelligent and stuff. And he is, and he still is, but there's much more of a humanizing element to him. And there's much more of a lack of, I think, hubris on his part, you know? And so what I like about Wesley in this episode is that he comes across as more of a realistic teenager, I think, in this season than last season. And I think that's really what I'm liking about it. I mean, you know, he hasn't had that many chances in this season to really shine so far. I mean, the Dauphin was kind of an episode about Wesley, and that was kind of a terrible episode.
Yeah.
This episode, I think, is it was smart because it does say, listen, you know, Wesley doesn't have much experience. And he would feel intimidated by giving orders and telling people what to do. And so that are older than him. But at the end of the day, he does it and everything is fine. The only problem I have with it is I kind of wish that he would have messed up at least a little bit. I think that would have been more. Fair. I think that would have been more realistic. I think having him sort of save the day by ordering this test was a bit too neat, but
I also feel that for Aang, and you know, part of it is maybe this, yeah, this was kind of a weird mission to send, to make him be his first, you know, command mission. I could see it be more realistic that, you know, it's time, but you're going to do, I mean, this is a long-term project. This is, I think, the longest time frame we've seen in an episode. It's implied to be a couple of months of time. At one point they're saying, you know, we've been working on this for 6 weeks.
Yeah, like, I thought that was really
strange.
This is
about 2 or 3 months that this episode takes place over. And they, so, I mean, it would be one thing if it's like, oh, we just need an away team to go down, get some minerals and come back and do, you know, it will take, you know, the better part of a week. Yes. But like that's something that would be a bit more realistic, to have him in charge of something for 6 weeks of this, or, you know, even if it would make sense, is okay, you're doing the day to day, but your report, you know, obviously I see why they didn't necessarily make a big deal of here's what the reporting structure of your mission is, because that would bog it down. But
I mean, that's a good point, because I think, you know, there's a degree to which I think the episode forgets that it takes place over such a long period of time.
Yeah.
You know, the only indication that much time has passed is really in, I think, one of the captain's logs, and
there's a few, yeah, it's that a few really, offhand mentions.
That really jumped out at me, because it seemed like a strange concept to interject into the episode that really doesn't have any bearing on anything, and nobody really acts like that much time has passed. I think that was kind of not a great, I mean, you know, there are problems to the episode. It's not a perfect episode.
That's, I guess, why I say the episode's missing something. Maybe it, you know, I guess it's stuff like that. It's all on the plot level that stuff doesn't work. But
yeah, I mean, if this had all been compressed down to, like, you know, a couple of days, I think it would have made a lot more sense. As it is, you know, for example, you know, Wesley having this problem with the iconograph or whatever he was telling them to do. You know, at that point, he would have been in charge of this for like 4 or 5 weeks. So I don't know that it makes a whole lot of sense that he would still be that reticent to give them orders. But
yeah, it's not the first thing he would have been challenged on, maybe, you know, and maybe the first major thing he was challenged on at that point. But, you know, there was something that, like, oh, gee, boss, this is a little more important. You know, if you're, you know, like, there would be minor things that would have come up.
Yeah.
Because the episode doesn't really care about its plot, because it very much uses its plot as a way to show these characters. And
well, what I like about Melinda Snodgrass' script for this episode is that she's willing to challenge the sort of tenets of the Next Generation. And what I mean by that is, you know, in a couple of areas. Number one, in the no fighting, you know, no personality conflicts area, because Wesley is obviously, you know, Wesley's obviously having some personality conflicts with the people in his crew, I think. And also he mentions to Riker at one point, well, what if there are personality conflicts? And that's interesting, because the show has been very, very clear that there aren't any, which I think is interesting. And I think it's something that Melinda Snodgrass, you know, I don't know how she was able to get that past Gene Roddenberry, but I like it.
You know, there's a few. It's actually funny, because I thought that's when he first talks to that one, you know, the one geologist or whatever, and he looks at the thing and said, oh, I wish you would have talked to me, you know. I wouldn't have put a married couple together, you know, but oh well. And you think, oh God, this guy's going to be difficult, but
he turns out not to.
Yeah, I was going to say that turns out to legitimately just be, it's his opinion, but, you know, because he can see, you know, all right, here, you know, I wouldn't be able to handle this as a thing. But Wesley proves to be able to deal with that. That particular married couple, I guess, is able to put any, you know, minor conflicts aside to work on the mission. You know, when he's, saying, you know, boss, we shouldn't be doing this. This is a waste of time. He's not just being stubborn. You know, he's genuinely believing that this is, you know, this is what he would do. I mean, we see this other incident as, I guess, not as capable as Wesley is. I mean, and that I think this episode makes it clear that it's not anything Wesley is missing in terms of intelligence or capability or any of that. It's just he is young. He hasn't done this before. This is the first time. And, you know, from this, I think we're going to see – I mean, they say he needs to build up his confidence. We are going to see a very – I mean, this would help Wesley's confidence, and he will be better at the next one and better at the next one.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I don't know that I necessarily agree with you that the ensign is less capable than Wesley. I just think that the ensign is below Wesley in this particular instance.
You know, the other ensign is much better at geology than leadership. You know, those are different skills.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a degree to which I think, you know – It's hard to say, because what I think the real point of that scene and what I'm thinking of is the scene where Wesley tells him to do the iconograph or whatever it's called, and he's kind of pushing back, and then Wesley is very unsure of himself, and he's like, well, maybe you're right. You know, I'm going to go jerk off now because I'm sad because he's 15, with Geordi in the holodeck. That, like, you know... I think the point of that is not to make Wesley out to be more capable than the ensign, but it's just to give an opportunity for Wesley to come back and give an order and for a guy to go, okay. Because what we've seen in this crew so far, I think, in the season and a half that we've been watching the show, is that Picard's style of command is to listen to everybody's input and then make a decision. And so I'm sure that this comes from down, you know, all the way down. It sort of trickles all the way down. And
I mean,
ensign is comfortable pushing back and saying, well, I don't think we should do this. But at the same time, I think what Wesley doesn't realize is that his responsibility is to listen to all of the input and then make his decision, not to use that input to sort of say, oh, well, OK, maybe that's not the right decision that I want to make. So for him, it's a lesson in, I think, Picard's style of leadership more than anything else.
Well, they explicitly, I think it's Riker who, you know, at one point says, well, you got to ask yourself right now, what you need to do is, what would Picard do in this situation? You know, for Wesley at 15 years old, emulating his captain is exactly the right way he should be proceeding right now. He can come up with his own style later on, but he kind of needs to be, he has a very excellent role model. And, you know, and Wesley does say, well, he would, you know, he'd ask everybody for their opinion, and he would then make a decision. And that's what he did, you know, and he does decide, you know, he does ask this ensign for his opinion, but then Wesley makes his own decision at the end. And
let's contrast this with the Data plot, because I find it really interesting that Wesley is able to make a mistake and then correct it, whereas Data is sort of, he's making a mistake by talking to this alien, and he keeps it from Picard for weeks.
Yeah.
And nothing good comes out of it. And so I think it's kind of intriguing that, you know, there's these two characters that are making the same mistake, but one is able to correct it and one really isn't. And the character that isn't able to correct it is the one who's more experienced, older, you know, ostensibly much more intelligent and capable.
Well, and also, you know, and I see, I think this is what Snodgrass understands Data really well and is very interested in Data. I mean, obviously her first episode was The Measure of the Man. So, I mean, in this episode, you have Data is supposedly all logic. He is supposedly going to make the rational decision, both based on the fact that he's an android and based on the fact that he is more experienced, and he does something which is wholly based on emotion. When he's talking to Picard, he says, oh, I know that whisper in the dark, you know, Picard knows what it's like to be very, very lonely in space and to not have that and to want to desire a connection with another being. And, you know, no, he's none of them fault Data for this, because they kind of all have been, but they do know that he is doing, quote unquote, the wrong thing. But I love that scene when they're all in the conference room and, you know, they're talking about and the Prime Directive, and they all go, and there are scenes where that and the scene where they're talking about, you know, what to do with.
And
Wesley.
I do want to talk about the Prime Directive in this episode, well, because it is a really important part of the episode.
Yeah.
But I want to correct you for a second, because they didn't have that conversation in the conference room.
Oh,
they had that conversation in Picard's quarters, and, well, I don't think that's incidental.
Then explain to me why.
Well, because the Prime Directive is something that is so central to the Federation and Starfleet that to even talk about breaking it psychologically for them means that they can't do it in a place that is a place where they conduct official ship business. It's almost like they're having some sort of conspiracy in a way.
Okay, that's not an unfair point.
And I also like the fact that they have refreshments at their conspiracy meeting.
Well, wouldn't you?
It's a very civilized society.
But yeah, you know, I like that scene because they're all talking and they have this, you know, they are all, you know, talking about it as a very theoretical thing. Like, we have this Prime Directive and our thing is we can't break the Prime Directive. No matter what, you know, the Prime Directive is our moral compass. It's what we balance our morality by breaking it, you know, and they go all this and they decide, you know.
Well, I don't think they're talking about morality. And I think that's the interesting
ethics
point. I think it's more ethics and I think it's more.
We've
talked about the Prime Directive before a lot. And I think what the Prime Directive is more it's a understanding that they don't know all of the permutations and all of the possible outcomes. And so, in effect, the best thing to do most times is to do nothing.
A non-interference policy, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, well, then maybe this episode – then let me correct. This is about the difference between ethics and morality, because when they're talking about the Prime Directive, they are talking ethical questions. You know, okay. And, I mean, Picard even throws a few hypotheticals. Okay, well, what if it's a disease, you know? Oh, yeah. Well, that, you know, we all absolutely got it.
We're a lot less sure.
Yeah. What about
decision?
A war, you know? Right. I don't know. What about a time, you know? And he's doing all of these theoretical things, but it isn't until the, you know, Data has the voice and they all hear this little girl and they all, like, you could tell they're, you know, even Worf, who was very strongly against, you know, we can't break this, you know, they're all feeling like, well, gee, now it's a moral issue at this point. Now it's an actual, I don't want to say humanized thing, but, you know.
And I think this is really, I mean, not the first episode of Star Trek where the ethics of the Prime Directive have, you know, come into direct conflict with the morality of a situation.
Yeah.
But I think this is the first time that this particular show has really grappled with that question.
Yeah. And I mean, the show ends with Picard talking to Data about this and he's saying, you know, sometimes, you know, they realize that in ignoring this girl and ignoring the plight of this planet, they are, in a sense, violating the spirit of what the Federation is for. And while they agree, I mean, they are in the wrong on the Prime Directive, they know. But I think there is the feeling that following the Prime Directive would have been the greater evil in this particular case.
And at the end of the day, though, do they violate the Prime Directive?
Well, they managed to figure out a way of,
I mean,
minimizing the damage in the best way possible. I mean, what they end up doing, so they fix this planet from kind of afar. Like, if Data hadn't had any contact with this girl, this would, you know, they would have just noticed their, you know, planet just suddenly calmed down.
Right.
The only thing, you know, Data has this, you know, actual contact with her. Pulaski erases her memory and, you know, he leaves this little souvenir, which she won't notice and she will get burned for as a wish later on when she wakes up. But other than that, you know, they try to minimize their collateral damage as much as possible on this one.
It's funny to me because, you know, this episode is really starting to lay bare the fact that you know, I may have some serious reservations about the Prime Directive because
fair.
They really fight against the idea of helping until they hear the voice of this little girl who's, you know, crying out for Data.
Yeah.
And They discover a way to fix her planet from exploding, basically.
Yeah.
I guess my problem with this, number one, is why does the Prime Directive stop them from trying to stop calamities, even if they can, you know, especially if they can do it from afar without the inhabitants of a planet knowing that they're doing it? Because
for me,
the issue really is, okay, we do this thing and we stop this planet from exploding and destroying itself, and that's the natural course of evolution for this planet or whatever. But to me, it's almost more arrogant to assume that that should, that's the better thing to have happen than helping this planet. Not giving them technology, talking to them, not revealing your existence at all. Yeah. But, you know, to me, it's kind of like, well, I don't want to leave my house because I might get hit by a car.
Well, there's a few things like, okay, in that, but, you know. Which, in this particular case, number one, they have that discussion after Data's already contacted this person and already has, you know, I mean, he's specifically talking about stuff like, I want to move this particular family to a safe location, and I want to... So he's talking about direct intervention. It's not, you know, they are still in the research phase. It isn't until towards the very end of the episode that they feel that they can save this, you know, if they... You know, it probably would have been the very easiest thing for them to arrange some kind of planet-wide exodus, and I'm sure if this had been a Federation planet... They would have done that. They would have been able to start sending a rescue fleet, especially with a several-month time frame.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
The reason they don't – you know, that's something that they absolutely cannot do. That, I mean, that's such a violation of the Prime Directive. It's ridiculous almost. But, you know, and I think if they had – if this planet were going to explode, if they couldn't figure out a way to do this, it's not like they would have – you know, again, they would have – helped the planet escape. If they would have
I mean, I think there's a degree to which the Prime Directive is an extremely cynical document for such a like sort of an optimistic society.
Well, because they also talked.
It seems like they don't know. I mean, admittedly, we all don't know the outcomes of actions before they happen, right? And unintended consequences are a real thing. But at the same time, to assume that. Because you don't know what the unintended consequences are going to be, that the unintended consequences are uniformly going to be bad and to be so bad that you should let an entire planet of sentient beings die.
You know, and
that seems strange to me.
And I will say some of the characters specifically say, like when they're talking about fate at one point, they are talking about fate. And I believe it was Troy is saying, you know, well, how do we know we're not part of the fate? Like we, you know, they're eliding the question of God at this point, but they are essentially talking if there is some kind of plan, either due to either quantum or divine or whatever, we were placed in the path of this planet, and we, you know, maybe us helping them is the way of the universe. I mean, yeah, they just happen to be there for a reason. That they can't ignore that. You know, they need to talk about to what degree the Federation is not sure whether it's an observer or a participant, I think. And the Prime Directive suggests that it wants to be an observer.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, that's problematic because the Federation is a political entity and has its own sort of needs and desires as well, right? And I also think that this will be an interesting conversation to think about in light of Q-Who as well.
Yeah.
Because that kind of puts this in a totally different light. It puts the Federation kind of in the opposite spectrum as well,
where it is the entity that is being affected rather than the one that is, you know, in other words, there the Enterprise still has, there are people who are years above the Federation and who are probably keeping them in their own Prime Directive kind of protection. Yeah, I mean, I have a feeling that, I don't know, it's kind of interesting because the Prime Directive seems almost designed to be something that seems great in theory. I mean, it sounds wonderful to say, well, gee, we don't want to just be these aliens coming in and, you know, changing the course of a planet. You know, we wouldn't like someone to, you know, that's arrogant to dictate, you know, that sounds wonderful. The fact that time and time and time and time again, we have episodes which are concerned with, well, do we break this or not? I think it's kind of inherent in it that the Prime Directive is problematic. In other words, I think that's kind of where the concept in the show gets some dramatic strength from, because if it had been this all-in-one situation that could be applied to anything and there would be no controversy, number one, there would be no show, and number two, I think it's important that this show agrees that even the best ethical situation has points where it can be immoral. And it wouldn't be the Federation if it didn't question itself, I think.
True. And I think as well, you could maybe make the argument, and maybe this is a little meta, but that the Prime Directive is itself an unintended consequence of the Prime Directive, right? Because they make this policy, you know, with the best of intentions and with the with the knowledge that they can't know everything. But then they get into situations which are directly caused by the Prime Directive. And so it's kind of this, you know, cyclical problem that the Federation and Starfleet has.
Yeah. I can see that. Yeah. And it's interesting in that, you know, this and The Measure of the Man are both about situations in which some of the ruling tenets of the Federation are shown to be incorrect, but where the Federation is, again, I said, you know, this is the Federation proving that it's quote unquote good because it's looking at its own laws in a way and saying, you know, well, the point of this is not just to be the law in and of itself. You know, the Prime Directive is not just something we have to follow arbitrarily, you know. It's something that's there for a reason. And, you know, it's there to protect other planets. It's there to protect them. It's there to protect, you know.
Yeah.
They don't – I mean, they very much – we see in world history plenty of situations in which, you know, a country armed another country and then found itself being attacked by it. You know, like, you know, I think – I mean, there is a degree that's not something they explicitly say on the show, but that's something that could happen here. We've seen that happen. Yeah.
Arsenal of Freedom.
Yes.
And – no, not Arsenal of Freedom. No. Too Short a Season.
Yeah.
With the old guy.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's one of the things that they want to protect against. They don't want to – yeah, they don't want to accidentally arm an underdog group and suddenly find that they're taking over the planet. They could make things worse in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, there's a degree to which, you know, the Prime Directive may be something that is forced upon them by circumstance as well.
We also aren't seeing, because we don't know
what the history of it is.
We aren't seeing situations in which following the Prime Directive to the letter was the complete right thing to do. I mean, it would be a very boring episode to say, you know, oh, we've scanned this planet and there's, you know, two groups at war. Should we arm one of them? No, it would be against the Prime Directive. Okay, next planet. I mean, that's a situation that happens, you know, pretty much. It's more interesting to see episodes in which following the Prime Directive is more problematic, and that's what's happening here.
Yeah, and I think there's a degree to which the Prime Directive is a great philosophy and a great, you know, moral compass, but at the end of the day, when you're sort of faced with the messy realities of you know, people, then it gets a lot more complicated.
And I think that's,
and maybe that's the point of this episode.
I was gonna say I think that sums things up very well. Yeah.
I give this episode 6 volcanoes.
I give it 7 because I was gonna give it 6, but I think talking about it a little more made me kind of thematically, it's a very interesting episode.
All right.
The plot's terrible, but I'm not watching this show for the plot, I think. And I like that.
Well, let's move on to Q-Who.
Q-Who!
Okay, so we met the Borg.
Okay, we did.
How do you feel about that?
You know, on the one hand, I mean, there were parts that were a little underwhelming about the Borg in this particular episode. I mean, possibly because I've seen them later on and, you know, they have a little bit of better handle on, you know, costuming and how they, you know, and talking on all of that. But that said, I liked this episode a lot because, I mean, obviously this is a very significant episode in the series mythology. The Borg, this series has tried to make the Ferengi happen. It's tried to make the Romulans happen, you know. I know that it makes the Borg happen. And so, you know, it has Q in it. It has, you know, Guinan is, you know, being revealed to be something more than she appears to be. There's that connect. They offhand mention the outposts on the neutral zone.
Yes.
Yeah. So those are supposed to. That's Borg related.
Yeah.
Is that what's the
that was that was the idea. Yeah. And the thing. Okay. So the thing about Q-Who is that it was supposed to come a lot closer to the neutral zone. The episode, not the actual neutral zone.
Oh, yeah.
But because of the writer strike, it didn't happen. And then they wrote this episode much later in the second season. And in the meantime, they moved from the original concept of the Borg as an insect race to the cyborg race that they are.
Okay.
Which I think was probably the right instinct because I just don't think the show would have pulled off an insect race very well at this point. Just in terms of, you know, costuming and makeup and stuff like that, I don't think it would have really worked very well. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, I've said in the past that the second season really has sort of two classic episodes of the show, and this is the second
one.
I can see why again. You don't have anything else to look forward to this season.
Yay!
We can just wrap it up and move on to The Ensigns of Command, which is the first season, the first episode of the third season.
Okay.
And, you know, it's the only appearance of Q this season, which I think is interesting. It's the only appearance of the Borg this season, which I think is interesting. And it's also an episode which, coming after Pen Pals, I think it doesn't explicitly reference anything that happened in that episode, but I think it does color the events of that episode in an interesting light, because what we see in Q Who is an alien which doesn't have any of the compunctions against action that the Federation and Starfleet does. And in effect, he has brought the Federation to the attention of an extremely dangerous alien species, which they are not ready to fight at all. And he doesn't seem to care.
Well, here's the thing. This is in a way. So in the previous episode, we have Wesley and everyone's discussing, oh, is Wesley ready to take command? Is he at this point? And, you know, in this, there's a very similar conversation between Guinan and Q at one point where there's, you know, and Guinan's on the thing of saying, you know, no, they're not ready for this. This is not, you know, this, the Federation is going to deal with this eventually, but no, it's not yet. Let them get there in their own time. And Q is acting rogue. You get almost the sense that there was some kind of coalition who knows about the Borg and is keeping the Federation in the dark about that. And Q, acting on his own, is saying, no, they're ready. I'm gonna force this conflict, you know. Let's get the Borg fought, you know, because I think Q realizes that the Borg are a very dangerous enemy and that they do need to be taken care of. And I think he thinks that the Federation is, it's time. And, you know, we could stall, we could wait, the Borg could get so many people, you know. Whether he's right or not, you know, is the question of this episode, and probably of the, I would assume that, you know, whether the Federation is ready to deal with the Borg or not is something that kind of comes up again, I would assume. But Q, I think, thinks they are. And, you know, Picard even says at the end, you know, well, gee, you know, we're kicked out of our complacency and, you know, whether or not we're ready, we got to be ready.
Well, I think, you know, it's interesting. Well, it's kind of problematic for me because Q, who was an episode which, in some respects, kind of reboots the show. I mean, because...
But it's needed one.
Well, yeah, I guess. But my problem with it is that, you know, we have a crew and we have a Starfleet and we have a Federation which is very capable, is very knowledgeable, and we don't really get a sense that they're complacent. We've seen them solve immense problems in the first two seasons, and for Q to come back, which again is a character which I've never been hugely fond of for reasons that we'll get into in future Q episodes. I don't think I'm spoiling anything to say that Q comes back once or twice a season.
I could see how he could get annoying.
And I think my problem with Q in this episode is I just don't feel like he has any motivation for doing anything that he's doing. And in effect, he's just being an asshole to be an asshole because the episode needs an asshole, because otherwise there would be no episode. And I don't know that that's the best way to introduce the Borg. I mean,
you know, I feel like this episode would have been a lot better if it had been the season finale, because a lot of the big elements about it, a lot of having Q come back, a lot of introducing the big bad of the series, a lot of that could be justified by saying, well, they wanted to leave it on a very interesting note. And I mean, to have Picard say that, well, you know, we're kicked out of our complacency, season ending, all right, we're going to see what's happening in the next season, would have been a better thing. The fact that we know that there's going to be an extra few episodes, yeah, does kind of, well, why did that happen? There is no even meta reason for that.
Yeah, and it just, I don't know, it just feels very, the Q stuff feels very sort of perfunctory in a way.
Yeah.
He comes back for really no reason. I mean, it just, you know, I feel like there could have been a better way to introduce the Borg that had nothing to do with Q. And of course, yes, you would miss the fantastic scenes between John DeLancey and Whoopi Goldberg Spielberg.
Yeah.
And they work really well together. And I think, you know, William Shatner, Patrick Stewart and John Delancey play off each other very well. Everyone plays off each other very, you know, with John Delancey very well. But this is the episode where you really need to buy Q, and you really need to buy the fact that he is doing this for some sort of reason. And I just don't get a sense that he's doing it for any reason whatsoever except to be a huge dick. And that's not a good enough reason for me.
He is fascinated by the Federation, by this particular crew. I can see how if he wants to, if he needs a mortal's help on anything, why he wants this crew. I can see why he fixates on this crew. That's all fine.
I guess I don't. But I guess that's my fundamental problem with
Q. I guess
Q.
Q's thing is he's very bored all the time. Q is your typical trickster who just, he's immortal. He's as omnipotent as we've seen any entity on this show be. He can do whatever he wants, and he has so few restrictions. And I think this, I can buy that this is one of the few or only groups of anything out there right now that's willing to sass him back, frankly. I think, you know, he appreciates that Picard is saying no and that Picard doesn't immediately capitulate to him every single time. I think Picard is one of the few challenges that Q is facing around these days. And
I mean, do you really think so? I mean, do you really think that if Q had appeared on the bridge of another random starship that the captain would go, oh, okay.
Yeah, but
I don't buy it.
Yeah, but that we have to buy that because we have to buy that this is the, you know, we have to buy that every time the Enterprise sees another ship that they're gonna fuck up or that they've been attacked by the alien of the week. We need to buy that the Enterprise is the only ship in any quadrant that is having a disaster. We need to buy that the most interesting things are happening to them just because there would be no show. You know, in a way, this.
I disagree. Actually, I think that. You know, I don't think we need that. I think what we need is, I mean, I've always thought of Star Trek as something which is expansive and can, you know, there are so many stories out there that any one ship flying around in space in the Federation is going to have adventures. And the fact of the matter is we've picked this one just because we need to have a TV show about one. But
and that's fair. And they're kind of they're kind of a microcosm of the Federation. But at the same time, also, to be fair, this is the one that Q's met. You know what I mean? I mean, it's not like Q has been to other. This was Q went to whatever Federation ship was going to go on the Farpoint mission. It happened to be the Enterprise. But he was the Q continuum took interest in humanity when humanity went beyond a certain point. And so Q met the Enterprise. Q met Captain Picard. And, you know, later in the – what's the next episode that he was in?
I don't know.
You know, the one where he gives Riker all of that power.
You mean from the past?
Yeah.
Hiding Q, I think.
Yes. They. Oh, my God. All of the Q episodes have awful titles.
Yes, they do.
They're not even puns.
And frankly, I don't know why this episode is called Q Who
it
at
has
all.
You know, so I think it's just the fact that he's met this group of people already. Again, Q is aboard and kind of, in a way, Q's kind of insecure.
So
he really needs a group of people to look up to him. And I think he enjoys just he likes Picard for a reason. He likes grinching the Enterprise. I really think that could be as much of it as he needs.
I guess.
Either way, you know, I don't know to which degree this is just a rabbit hole that we're going in because
no, I don't think it is because, I mean, Q is, a fairly important part of the Next Generation's mythology. And frankly, I've never understood why. So, you know, I think this is probably something that we can talk about again when Q reappears.
Okay. So,
and I also think that there's a degree to which they still don't really have a grasp on how Q works in the show the best because – to my knowledge, you know, right now he's menacing. I mean, I think Picard calls him like an agent of chaos at one point.
Well, he's a trickster figure. He's a trickster god.
Well, yeah, but I think, you know, I think there's a degree to which, you know, we're supposed to think of him as dangerous. And I don't think that he would ever do anything directly to harm the Enterprise crew. But indirectly, certainly he does. And 18 people die in this episode because of his actions.
Yeah, and I think there's I kind of this is for whatever reason, and they should have made Q's motivation for doing this a little clearer, I agree. But Q, for whatever reason, decides he needs to let the Federation know that the Borg exists, that there is this entity out there, this collective, whatever they are, that is going to eventually come for them. And that he believes that out of the groups in the galaxy at this moment, the Federation probably has the best shot of fighting back. And so, I mean, how else would he let the Federation know?
Well, I guess, well, actually, this is making a little bit more sense to me, because I think if you look at Q as someone who wants stimulation and wants someone to argue with and sort of wants, you know, very human dramatic moments in his life, the Borg would terrify him because they're boring.
Yeah.
Not because
they're Borging.
Yes. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Not that they kill people, and not that they, you know, it's just that they're boring. They're just boring, and he's afraid of that because he doesn't like to be bored, and he likes alien races and people out there that entertain him, and so
he likes diversity, and the Borg is all about sameness,
right? And that's what I think. Yeah, maybe that's the real key here, is that, you know, he wants the Federation, in a real way, I think Q wants the Federation to succeed because he finds these people the most interesting of any of the other alien races that are out there. And I think he finds them interesting, you know, for reasons that may or may not be clear, may or may not become clear in the future. But, you know, he pushes the Federation, you know, he pushes the Enterprise out 7,000 light years to meet the Borg, you know, not because he wants to be a dick to them, but because he actually wants to do the opposite. And I think in a way,
I mean, when he says, when they say like 18 people died, and, you know, Q says, look, it's really dangerous out here. Like, there are a lot of awesome things out in this part of the galaxy. Like, you're going to see some real serious shit soon, but like, you have to know, like, you need to be really careful. How more could he show that the Borg are a threat, but by letting entire sections of the ship get destroyed and over a dozen people? And remember, on a ship of how many hundreds of people, only 18 really do die. Those are the only casualties. That is a small number. It's a huge number to Picard and to the Federation. And yes, it's good that it's a
good unfortunately number. That was the area of the ship where the classroom was, so all 18 of those people were 5-year-olds.
So, in other words, the Borg did a favor to the Federation.
Yeesh.
I don't.
I think a few of our listeners have kids. You just destroyed them.
I'm sorry. Well, just like the Borg destroyed the classrooms of the ship.
No, and I...
Yeah, I think that's... I think his point is real. Like, he's like... He's just saying, you know, this is 18 people getting killed on just one encounter with the Borg that you escaped from. Imagine, you know, if you hang out in this part of the galaxy, you're gonna have a lot more dangerous situations. You know, this isn't a game. This isn't fun. This isn't just... You know,
I don't think that's his point at all.
I think
actually.
That is his point. Well, no, what do you think his point is?
Well, number one, I don't think he's telling them to be careful. I think he's doing the exact opposite. He's saying you can't be careful out here. I think there's a degree to which Q is interested in the Federation, interested in Starfleet, not because that they're intrinsically interesting. I think because they are one of the only groups in that part of the galaxy that are out there exploring. They're out there looking for new experiences, looking for new life, looking for new things in general. You know, the Romulans to him, for example, would not be interesting because the Romulans are, you know, a very sort of rote political entity that is very, very, you know, understandable as a political entity, which is just expanding to find resources, expanding to find population, expanding to do these things.
And he even dismisses the Romulans. You fought the Klingons, you fought the Romulans.
Right.
Like
the Federation and Starfleet is a group of people that I think Q really does believe that they are the group in this part of the galaxy that could push everybody else forward in a way. Because if you look at the Q continuum as a race of, you know, omnipotent beings that are interested in new experiences and interested in finding out all they can about the galaxy, Yeah, they, you know, they probably would be interested in Starfleet, and they would be interested in the Federation, because this is a group that is explicitly saying, no, we are out here to explore. We are out here to do things that no one else has ever done before or seen before. And so Q is saying, you guys need to realize that space is not safe, and you guys need to realize that you have a golden opportunity here to really push yourself forward and make life so much more interesting than it is right now. And I'm pushing you to do that.
There's, in a way, he's saying there's maybe then he's saying there's a price to pay for these wonders. Like, you can't, you know, you can see these great things, but you have to accept the danger. You can't do this. Yeah, maybe. Yeah. You can't do this safely. If you want to be safe, you stay on Earth. You stay in your area, and that's fine. You can hang, but you say you want conquest. You know, when they went past Farpoint in that first episode, that was essentially them accepting that they would face the likes of the Borg one day. And, you know, maybe that's part of Q's motivation. Like, maybe he sees that as the logical endpoint.
That could be, yeah.
I almost feel like, to a degree, and, you know, I guess when you say about, you know, what you're saying about the Federation, I don't think Q is completely insincere when he is saying, like, I want to join your crew. He's always in a Starfleet uniform, and I think I think he genuinely thinks this is the one group that, number one, will have him. And, you know, the Q continuum doesn't want him. This is, I kind of think, the one place he feels like he belongs. We do have a crew of misfits. I mean, I know he doesn't join the crew, but he would fit in there.
I don't know how they're a crew of misfits. I found that line odd.
Well, they all are. Everyone's really different on this crew. Everyone has a very different character. You have all of these different alien races and, you know, working together for this one common goal. The Federation is a federation of different planets, of different species.
But I don't know how that makes them misfits. I guess that's my problem with that. It just doesn't make sense to me.
It's not like, I don't know. I mean,
I think it's just a bad line.
Yeah. Take as one of the, I mean, if you go with the original series as having this very diverse crew to show of, you know, again, putting a black woman on the bridge of the Enterprise was something that in real life was not happening. You know, you have a, you know, it's always intended to, the Federation is always intended to be a little more diverse, a little more welcoming than real life is at any one moment. And so I think when he says crew of misfits, it's more of a, I think that's just the phrasing of a diverse crew at that point.
Okay. All right.
Hell, you have a bartender who's apparently got a lot of secrets. I mean, you know, why not Q? I mean, Q would do some wonderful things with the Federation, except, you know, Picard is honest when he says, you know, you're not predictable enough. And yes, Q would get bored on the crew of the Enterprise. He would want to do something else. It's not in his nature to do the same thing all the time.
Leaving Q aside, we haven't really talked about the Borg, and I'm curious what you think of them, if they make any impression at all in this episode.
They, you know, we really don't see much of them in action. And,
right.
Now, I know little bits about where the Borg end up going. I know Seven of Nine is a character. I know there are, you know, and the Borg do get incarnated into specific individuals, or you see specific units or something like that. I don't know that too well, but, you know, which is just a way of giving a recurring kind of face for the viewers, in a way, I would assume. But either way, they don't do much. They are a weird-looking ship. They're weird-looking people. They're vaguely threatening, but that's about what we see of them. We're really just getting the introduction, and I mean, even Q says, you know, this is a preview of something that you're going to face at some point.
Yeah.
So, as a introduction to this mysterious force, this mysterious entity, this mysterious race, or whatever, I thought it was effective. I thought that, I mean, we only really should see kind of shadows of them right now.
Well, and I think the other thing, too, is that, you know, I think what we really have to do is compare them to the Ferengi, because they're obviously a much more effective villain than the Ferengi ever were.
Yeah. Well, they
and if you look at it just on a production level for them saying, we need an alien race that is more threatening than the Ferengi, then this is it.
Well, you see a number one, you see a ship that's completely un-aerodynamic in every way. Like even accepting that, you know, the laws of, you know, that does not apply in space, you know, there is something that
I'm glad you said that, because I was about to yell at you.
No, I know. Like it doesn't matter, but you still see a block. How is that thing flying? It should not fly. There is something. So, I mean, every, you know, usually spaceships, when we see them on, you know, on TV, are based in some way on an Earth spaceship. You know, we it's based on the space shuttle, which is that way for a reason. You know, things like that. This is not, there are no ships in the world that look like this. And
yeah, well, and I think, and I mean, you know, I don't want to go down a rat hole of talking about, you know, starships and no. Star Trek, but, you know, I think there's a degree to which you have, you know, it's, yeah. It's important to realize that, you know, the original Enterprise from the original series, you know, Gene Roddenberry very much did not want a rocket ship,
yeah.
Which was the standard of the time. And so what you get is something that is completely unique to Star Trek.
Yeah.
And so, you don't get, you know, but over time, I think what happens is you get a Star Trek style of starship.
Yeah, I mean, we see
you've
the
got
other
the Klingons,
star-
you've got the Romulans, you've got the Ferengi. They all look slightly different.
You can see an area where this is a main section where the crew probably is. This is where the engines are. You can see, you know, you could probably guess at what areas are for what.
But in this Borg, you know, this Borg ship, which is basically a giant cube, is just something which is so totally unique and so totally different
like nothing,
from anything
yeah.
that we've seen before, that it's a bit, I think it's off-putting, really.
Yeah, I was gonna say, it's just the design of the ship is creepy because, you know, that's not how ships work in this universe.
And I also think there's a degree to which, you know, the Borg are threatening not because they're the Borg, but because they are able to overpower the Enterprise so quickly and so rapidly.
Well, yeah, I remember and this is Arsenal of Freedom. No, what was the one where they have the ultimate weapon? Was that called the ultimate weapon? Where they're like, they're on the planet and there's like that probe and like they shoot it. And then like 20 minutes later, the other probe comes and it has like,
yeah, the Arsenal of Freedom.
Yeah. I mean, that essentially that happens here. They kill one Borg and then another one appears, you know, with shielding against it. But it happens instantaneously. There is no delay between that. So you think of this. So not only is this, you know, this is an enemy which is infinitely adaptable. I mean, it.
Yeah. And I think there's a degree to which it was a really smart decision to have it be, okay, you get one shot at these guys and then that's it. You know,
yeah.
You get one shot with your phaser. The next one that comes, the phaser's not going to work.
With the photon
torpedoes.
You
get a couple shots with your photon torpedo. Once you do that, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
They're so much faster than you. They can collapse your shields in 30 seconds.
In a way, it's bad that they're attacking it because they're teaching it what their capabilities are. You know, they're telling it exactly in which way to adapt. And I think the fact that the Borg are almost completely silent in this works to its advantage because, I mean, they don't have the hissing, you know, feral Ferengi that are, you know, the Borg never become silly.
Yeah, the only thing they say really is don't defend yourself or you know, we'll destroy you or whatever they say. And that's basically it.
And the fact that it's this like two sentence just very calm ultimatum that's, you know, it's not even really threatening per se, which makes it even more threatening. You know,
I don't think they're not interested in threatening.
They don't,
they're just,
because it's stupid to threaten them.
Right.
You know, what's their point? They don't need to waste the energy there.
Right.
When they're on the ship, they say they don't even either notice it or they don't consider them a threat. Like they're treating the three of them almost like, you know, if we saw like an ant on the floor, like we wouldn't go out of our way to kill it if it were in the ship, like whatever, it'll get taken care of. We'll have someone put out a trap later on.
Yeah, I think so.
In and of itself, I guess, would this episode, if I didn't know Borg were a thing, if I didn't know Q were a thing, if I just saw this episode, would it be effective? I wonder if that's something that needs to be considered, because I
think it would be. I mean, and I think the reason for that is just because the Borg are so relentless and the Borg are so overpowering in this episode that there's a sense of dread that permeates
yeah.
the entire episode, even to the point where, you know, like 10 forward is lit darkly and
yeah.
You know, it just feels like an oppressive episode. And I think, you know, I
yeah.
think that's really what
There is no comic relief really in this.
I mean,
even, you know,
Ensign Wacky Sonya or whatever, with the hot chocolate.
I hated her, but...
Oh, that's too bad. I kind of like her, where she's talking to the machine like it's a person.
That was cute, though, because she is post-Measure of a Man, in a way. Like, you know, they do say, you know, well, this is intelligence in that episode. So, yeah, some people would be super polite to the replicator just to be nice to it, because what if, you know?
It may have feelings.
So let's what I think is interesting is that they are starting to set up the Borg as kind of the dark mirror of the Federation, because you have the Federation and all of these groups who are working together, but it's a group of individuals. You have the Borg, who is a group of all of these things, but they're acting as one. And it's kind of the – and that's horrifying. They almost say that there is – too much disagreement is bad, the show thinks. You know, when having conflict among people who are working towards the same goal is bad, and we should work together, and, you know, it's not – but on the other hand, yeah, it's also saying that, but we need to preserve some sort of individual identity, or this is not worth anything. The Borg is not the ultimate form of the Federation. It's the ultimate perversion of the Federation, really. And so I think that does make a very effective, you know, major villain. And that might even, again, be another reason that Q wants to use the Federation kind of as his weapon against the Borg. Because they are the moral equivalent. They are how to do a group society right.
All right. I give this episode 8 Borg cubes.
I wanted to give it 8.
You can give it 8.
I'm going to give it 8 Borg cubes.
All right.
32 suds.
Well, next week, we've got Samaritan Snare and Up the Long Ladder.
Oh, no.
And one of these two episodes is written by Melinda Snodgrass.
Oh, boy.
So be excited.